Coming up in This Week in Computer Hardware, Dell's XPS 13 2-in-1. Intel's putting data centers before PC consumers. There's a new Optane website. Lenovo X1 Yoga OLED is awesome. 50 gigabytes of Fallout. Do you need an 8-gigabyte GPU? And the iPhone ship in a bottle. All that and more coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and once again, time for Twit's audience survey. We'd really like to hear from you. It's only going to take a couple of minutes, really. That's all. Just go to twit.tv/survey and let us know what you think. Your anonymous feedback will help us make Twit even better. And thanks for your continued support.
This is Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 402, recorded February 16, 2017. Ship in a bottle iPhone. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by IT Pro TV, an easy, entertaining approach to online IT training. Visit itpro.tv/twitch and use the code TWITCH30 for a free 7-day trial and 30% off the lifetime of your account. And by Blue Apron, the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. See what's on the menu this week and get 3 meals free with your first purchase with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/twitch. And by BarkBox. BarkBox Paw picks the best all-natural treats and innovative toys for your dog and ships them right to your door. To receive a free month of BarkBox with your 6 or 12-month subscription and free shipping, visit getbarkbox.com/twit. Welcome to Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you the most useful, most informative, most engaging, and yes, even the most delightful news in PC and mobile hardware. Joining us today, Mr. Alan Malventano of beautiful Florence, Kentucky. How you doing, man?
How's it going?
It's good. I'm here. A little chilly, but nice.
Is it still like 18 degrees there?
No. It's like in the 30s.
Okay. So it's a reasonable temperature at this point.
Yep.
Oh, my goodness. Big news, whole bunch of news this week. We're going to try to jam through as much of it as we can. One of the craziest stories, or maybe not so crazy, maybe something we've been anticipating for a while, as Intel has sort of missed the mobile bandwagon and is trying to establish itself at the forefront of the Internet of Things in terms of chip sales and getting back on the bandwagon it probably missed when it walked away from ARM licensing. The title from PC World is Intel Demotes PCs, Giving Data Center Chips First Crack at New Technologies. Yeah, there was a boom up there if you're watching the video version of this one. Intel basically sat down last week, and I didn't really quite dig into this story. They basically said the total available market for its PC CPU business was just $30 billion or so, less than half of the data center. And Mark Hockman wrote that up for PC World. So essentially, the TAM is all of the money that's being spent in that sort of segment of the market. And data centers are at like $65 billion. That's the big green arrow in that chart. Optane, non-volatile, Optane memory, they're looking at like a $55 billion total market. That's the big red arrow in there. Premium mobile is the orange arrow. And the little tiny blue one is kind of industrial, video, retail, Internet of Things stuff. But you'll notice that the data center green arrow is a heck of a lot bigger than the PC CPU. But of course, one thing there may be, you probably can't read it at home, but that data center arrow includes networking, 3D XPoint technology, photonics, Intel Optipath. So this is kind of Intel officially saying we're going to give the good stuff to the data centers first. And I think what that really means in terms of consumers is that as they lower processes and move to new fab lines, they're going to go to the data centers first rather than the consumer processors, which on one hand opens up a wonderful opportunity for AMD, who would love to step in as the enthusiast processor of choice. We'll see. We'll see how it goes.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't surprise me that they kind of went this way. They've already, Intel has been this way on the storage side for a while. You know, mainly you would get like the enterprise version of whatever their SSD is, and then they would kind of repurpose that technology and kind of like distill it down into a consumer version. You know, to some extent, that's kind of changing around back and forth a little bit, but for the most part, that's how it's been for the past, you know, several years now. And, you know, it just kind of makes sense, right? Like, as far as processor side goes.
Go where the money enterprise,
is. Yeah, go where the money is, right?
Or the total maximum possible amount of money. So,
well, yeah, I mean, they are in a business. You know, business is supposed to make money, so.
I suppose that's reasonable. It's, speaking, you know, of making money, businesses at Intel, for just an awkward segue, if ever I had one, you took a closer look at Intel's Optane SSD DCP4800X. Let us talk of enterprise SSD performance round two.
I took a closer look at the specs that were leaked. This is probably like the fourth leak of Intel Optane stuff. You know, a lot of the sites that covered this, they just kind of like rattled off all the numbers. And I took a step back and went, all right, well, what does that actually look like compared to like the current enterprise, you know, NAND flash based parts that are out there? And so if you scroll down a little bit more on that page, I decided to kind of like lay those specifications out in a form of what might they look like in our results if we were to review that item. Right?
Sure.
Just kind of assuming that it would at least perform as well as the specs rated it for, which, you know, safe bet for an Intel part. They usually don't overestimate the performance of their products. So if you look on that chart right there, there's a red line running between 500,000 IOPS and 550,000 IOPS. And then compared to the two most recent enterprise parts that we reviewed, And if you notice, the other two lines are kind of like about a fifth of the way up compared to that Optane part.
Whoa.
Yeah. It's a pretty big change there, right?
dramatic is not quite strong enough.
Something to note here, particularly to this chart, is that, you know, we're just looking at the random access speed of this thing, right? And it's basically if you're doing... all reads is on the right side, and then if you're doing a bunch of writes, that's on the left side, and then everything in between is kind of, you know, as it goes across the chart there. We're looking at queue depth 16, which means that you're asking 16 things at the same time. You're basically 16 requests simultaneously. And NAND flash-based parts, especially NVMe ones, the flash takes a certain amount of time per request, which is kind of a relatively long amount of time if you think about it. But if you start stacking a bunch of them in parallel, it has the ability to kind of accelerate it somewhat. Well, those two parts on the bottom of that chart don't reach their full speed until you do 256 requests at the same time.
That's a lot of requests.
That's a lot of requests. And it's actually, if you look at the chart, the kind of like chart that's the Intel provided chart, which is one below that, most of the workloads, even in enterprise, where you might think that they would be super heavy workloads as far as how many things are running simultaneously, is actually not, right? The majority of requests are taking place all the way down like queue depth 1 through 10 or 20 or something like that. So what's key there is that this cross-point stuff, or in Intel's case, their branding is Optane, it's able to reach its maximums with only 16 requests at the same time compared to 256 for the technology that it's competing against, right?
Right.
So that's pretty substantial, right? And the fact that it's going so much faster also means that if you had the NAND-based SSD or the, you know, Optane-based product both doing the same kind of heavy random workload, since the Optane one is going faster in the first place, it will actually be at an even lower queue. Right, because it's able to respond, it's able to answer those things faster in the first place. And the system is only giving the requests at a certain rate, you know, based on whatever it's doing, whatever its needs are, right?
Sure.
So cool stuff there, right? So obviously just in the random workload chart looks pretty amazing, right? At least on paper. The next one down there, which is another couple of charts, which is our quality of service. And this is this is something that's very important to enterprises because they care about, like, okay, what about the edge case requests? Like, say the SSD got caught up doing something in its firmware or whatever, and every so often you have a request that takes maybe a little longer than the bulk of them. And that's called quality of service in terms of SSD performance. Their stated quality of service claims are already put it like worst case time required for any request, for like the longest request out of a whole batch of them. The worst case is more than 10 times quicker than we have measured from actual products that are NAND based. And that's the worst case figure. The actual like their specs right out of their product for this Optane part say the typical latency is less than 10 microseconds for a request, which is actually the left edge of my chart. So I'm going to have to like re-engineer how we do our tests and produce our results in preparation for when we do test an Optane, you know, product in our lab, because it will just be off scale to the left. Like the latencies will be too low. So looks dang impressive. Just looking at now that we have actual specs from something that's the product that's supposed to launch pretty soon. Pretty impressive. The last thing that was pretty impressive was you rate enterprise parts in something called drive writes per day. Mm-hmm. So how many times could you fill the whole volume of the drive, or at least write that much worth of stuff over the course of one day? And typical ratings are like one drive write per day, maybe three or five if you're really kind of pushing it. This thing's rated at 30. So
wow.
You can completely, and it doesn't, and since it's Optane technology, which you can write randomly single bytes even, flash memory, you have to like kind of juggle around pages and blocks in order to rewrite small sections, which results in you kind of amplifying how much work the flash does compared to how much you thought you were trying to write to it. You know, if you only write 4K to an SSD, you potentially rewrote like 6 megabytes.
Right.
This stuff, if you write 4K to it, you only have written 4K. So it's, you know, it doesn't have to redo anything or reshuffle anything around. So the fact that it can do 30 full volumes worth in a day, and I think that rating is based on like a 5-year lifetime or something like that. That's pretty staggering compared to, you know, anything that's a NAND-based part, right? It's still what the funniest thing out of all this is that the performance specifications, the endurance specifications, all that stuff actually technically falls short of what Intel initially claimed, Intel and Micron, when they launched Crosspoint, right? But that launch was talking about, like, here is if you compared the raw performance of the cells of this memory type versus the cells of this memory type, you kind of lose some along the way when you actually turn it into something that's an actual product that, you know, in this case, has to talk over a protocol, NVMe, which, you know, NVMe is probably somewhat of a bottleneck in this case because this memory is extremely quick, right?
Right.
And NVMe was, you know, really meant more for NAND-based products when it was designed, right? So pretty cool stuff. You know, hopefully we'll have something to actually test shortly.
That would be nice.
We might have a smaller version of that to test. We might not be looking at like this enterprise thing right off the bat. We might actually be more likely to look at what is coming up in the next story.
That Intel has quietly launched the official Optane memory site.
Well, Optane, they did.
The other name for Crosspoint.
Yeah. Well, Optane is Intel's brand name for Crosspoint. Intel launched it jointly with Micron. Micron calls it QuantX, which is kind of a weird name, but okay. So they launched their Optane memory site, and what you will not find on this site is anything about that data center SSD that we just talked about. What you will find is kind of the first consumer product that we're going to see come from Crosspoint Memory, which is the Intel Optane, they call it the Optane Memory 8000P series. And it's available only in a 16 gigabyte or 32 gigabyte capacity. And these things only speak at PCIe 3.0 by 2. So it's only 2 lanes of PCI Express, whereas normal NVMe SSDs are, you know, use 4 lanes. So you have kind of a bottleneck there, and you have a capacity bottleneck as well. You're not going to be installing Windows to this thing. That's right. Not what it's for.
But that's not its purpose. Its purpose is to sit in between an incredibly inexpensive traditional rotating media, disk hard drive, and then to cache the most necessary and convenient files and give you, you know what I mean? Like it's a super hybrid hard drive, except for it's not a hybrid hard drive because it's another module sitting on the motherboard rather than a bunch of memory and logic sitting inside of an enclosure.
Right. And you can do things that are a little bit more creative when it comes to trying to implement a cache on slower media if you have that cache sitting like at the operating system level, which is what it would do in this case, right? It would most likely be implemented through Intel's, you know, RST, just like the typical Intel driver that some people out there might be familiar with. There already was a form of that built in, and that was years ago now. Where you had this rapid storage technology, and Intel was selling like a 20 gigabyte SLC based SATA SSD that was supposed to be added as a layer of cache to your hard drive that was sitting right next to it. That stuff kind of died on the vine back then because around the same time you could start buying like 64 gigabyte or higher, regular NAND SSDs. That's when they started to become popular and the prices started to drop reasonably quickly. So a lot of folks out there just said, well, I'm not going to buy this kind of expensive 20 gig thing when I could just buy like 64 gig. And if I already bought 64 gig, why use it as a cache? I'll just put my operating system on it and kind of keep my bigger stuff on the hard drive. Right. So that mentality shift that happened kind of, you know, pulled the rug out from underneath their caching technology. But now, even now, with SSDs having been out so long, you still have OEMs that are shipping systems with hard disks in them without SSDs, right? It's not all of them. Right. Granted, you can get systems with SSDs in them, but it's still the majority of them being sold still have hard disks in them. So if you can get an OEM to install, you know, a small 16 gig cache item that, you know, hopefully would cost them maybe 10 or 15 bucks or something for the part, but get so much of a performance increase for the typical kind of things that you're going to be doing on that system, you know, it'd be worth it, right? Like 16 gig of cache for your storage system. And if it's doing that caching in an intelligent way through the Intel RST software so that it can take like the best advantage possible of it, say, you know, every time it sees like random writes, it just kind of puts those on the Optane part. Whereas, you know, that you're basically leaving the hard drive to be able to handle all the straight line sequential stuff, which hard drives, you know, are much better at. So, you know, hopefully we'll end up seeing, it would be very nice. Like recently I had to do an operating system reinstall for someone that had a system that was a couple of years old, that had a hard disk in it, no SSD. It was painful. You know, it took hours to redo this system, whereas I knew it would probably have taken like 20 or 30 minutes to do the same if this was an SSD equipped system, like the same system. So it'll be nice if the kind of systems that we run into in the future, if they had hard disks, at least would have a little bit of this Optane stuff on there, and it would just make things go that much quicker, right?
Right.
Not as expensive as, you know, a terabyte of solid state installed in that system, but it could have like a terabyte or 2 terabyte hard drive, you know, little 16 gig or 32 gig of this stuff. And, you know, the effective performance would be a lot closer to solid state than it would be to hard disk speeds. Right.
There you have it.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. We should take a moment to thank the crew at IT Pro TV. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by IT Pro TV. Opportunities in the tech industry are growing faster than in any other job market. There's no time like the new year to start a new career in tech or move up the ladder, but you don't have to go back to school to do it. IT Pro TV is the best way to stay up to date with current IT certifications. IT Pro TV offers over 2,000 hours of content, and more than 30 hours are added each and every week. You can stream courses live and on demand worldwide, your Chromecast, Roku, Amazon Fire TV, Apple TV, or your PC, and they recently launched their Apple TV app. Course topics include certified information system security professional comp, TIA Project Plus, networking plus, ethical hacking V9, AWS solutions, pen testing. Transcripts are so convenient. They let you follow from start to finish or jump to any part of the video. 100 plus step-by-step virtual machine labs and Transcender practice exams. Those are $109 value right there. Good stuff. IT Pros TV's clients include Harvard, MIT, UCSD, Stanford, and so many more. Take advantage of their low monthly subscription price and no-hassle cancellation policy. Premium annual memberships are normally $57 a month or $570 a year, but we have a special offer for our listeners. For a free 7-day trial and 30% off the lifetime of your account, go to itpro.tv/twitch and use the code TWITCH30. And heads up, IT Pro TV will introduce a new membership level soon, and all current premium members will be granted the highest membership level available, so sign up today. Visit itpro.tv/twitch and use the code TWITCH30. And we want to thank IT Pro TV for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. We should take a moment to talk about Crucial adding to their MX300 line.
This is the MX300, which they initially launched as a 750 gig part, which was kind of an oddball capacity. But they eventually kind of reworked that line, and then they actually discontinued the 750 gig, and they introduced capacities that are more closer to what people were used to. But recently they upped that even further to a 2 terabyte model. A little bit higher than 2 terabytes, actually. It's like 2050 or something like that. I mean, these are reasonably good performing drives. They do this dynamic flipping of which mode the flash is running in. So initially it starts out where most of it is in SLC mode. And then as it starts to get full over time, it'll kind of shift some of that empty flash over to TLC mode so that it's able to put more bits in that. And it always keeps a little bit of it available. It always keeps like 10 or 16 gigabytes worth of SLC, in that mode and ready to receive information. So you end up with kind of sort of like what a Samsung Evo drive does, where it has a certain amount of SLC cache. But at the same time, the endurance of this drive, like if you got the 2 terabyte model and you only ever put like 500 gig on it, it would have the endurance in the end of something more like an SLC SSD. So your potential endurance would be much higher. And the other thing that's cool about this is that I think we looked it up last night on the podcast, the 2 terabyte model was selling for like 25 cents a gig, something like that. Didn't even look like it was a sale. It was just like, that's what the price was. Pretty cost effective there. I think the equivalent 2 terabyte 850 Evo was running like $700, and this MX300 was running like $550. So it's an extra $150 off. Now, granted, it's not going to perform as well as that Samsung part, but when you start shaving another 20% or so off of the cost of something, I wouldn't be surprised if people just went this way. Still a decent performer. So
I can live with slightly slower performance in exchange for a reduction in price like that. Or you could buy two MX300s and put them in RAID.
Yeah, you could.
Oh my goodness. Yeah,
that'll make up for it, more than that. Considering that most SATA SSDs these days are just riding the SATA bottleneck itself. So, yeah. It totally makes sense if you can just make sure you got your backup strategy in play there. But yeah, you can totally RAID 0 a couple of them and basically double all the specs.
Oh my goodness. I like that thought. Double all the specs quickly, just double, and efficiently.
Yep.
We got hands-on this week on TechThing, Dell's XPS 13 2-in-1, their latest iteration of the XPS 13 lineup. Same fantastic display. You can just kind of see it down there, except, of course, the 2-in-1, it's got the rollover tablet in tent mode right there, which is particularly nice if you've ever had the nose cam experience with the Dell XPS 13, because the web camera is right down there, and you end up shooting video like this, which isn't the worst angle.
Except it isn't the best one either.
Like this, yeah. but you can put the XPS 13 2-in-1 in tent mode. and have the camera center at the top of the screen. Screen's QHD Plus, 3200 by 1800, or full HD, 1920 by 1080. Same exterior aluminum, carbon fiber palm rest, 0.54 inches thick. Hi, Shannon. Thin, like too thin for a USB 3 Type A port. Keyboard and mouse still feel good. And it's running a fanless CPU, a fairly low-power CPU. It's interesting, right? In terms of ports, it's like one Thunderbolt 3 display port over USB-C, a micro SD card slot, which is really useful to me because I'm always playing around with micro SD cards for, you know, either I'm loading stuff up for an Android device or for Raspberry Pis or grabbing stuff off a camera. It's got the Microsoft Hello fingerprint reader built in there. And the one thing about it is the processor. You know, you're talking about an Intel Core i7 7Y75, which is running at like 1.3 gigahertz, 1.6 gigahertz maxed out. Was about, you know, we started running some video on some video encodes on that, and it was what I will affectionately call considerably slower. Day-to-day operations, like, you know, you're working in spreadsheets, you're doing video, you're watching videos online, you've got, you know, 82 tabs open, no problem. Rendering video on that was about half as fast as on a standard XPS 13. So if you're not a content creator, you're probably good to go. The fanless design is really, really sweet if you hate noise. But you pay for that by the TDPs lower, so the amount of work it can do is going to be significantly lower than a bigger, thicker laptop with a fan inside of it. You know, pretty nice. I also offer a Dell Active Pen for $50 on that one if you want to get your sort of Wacom tablet technology, you know, fold it over into book mode and write on it with the tablet. I like it. I can't use it personally because of the amount of rendering I need to be able to do with video. The time delta is so huge. But for day-to-day, keyboard feels good, mouse feels good, or the touchpad feels good, screen looks fantastic, and it's light. Which I'm a big fan of, 2.7 pounds. Version we looked at was $1,300. That's the Dell XPS 13 model 9365 2-in-1. And that's up on Dell's website now. You have been in love with Lenovo's ThinkPad X1 Yoga. You have written a full long-term review subtitled, OLED is amazing.
It is. I mean, there's just no way around that. I am the type of person that, like, the only thing I really do with laptops is just on the go, like just writing. Like if we're covering a press event or whatever, we're just, you know, doesn't need to be a spectacular machine, really.
Right.
Right. At least in my mind. So I mean, for the longest time, I was using a really, really old, like, piece of garbage laptop. And then one of these showed up at the office. And I figured, I took one look at the screen and I was like, hey, I think I really need something like a better laptop that I need to use this. So I kind of commandeered it. The screen is just flipping amazing. I mean, so first of all, it's a Lenovo Yoga style machine, right? So it does the whole convertible tablet thing, tent mode, all that stuff you were just talking about with that Dell machine. Lenovo's kind of been at this for a little bit longer, right? Because I think they were like one of the first to do the whole yoga thing, right. You know, as far as mobile systems goes. But you combine all that stuff, and you know, I mean, everything is more up to date. Obviously, it's a recent system, so it's you know, Skylake. I think the one I was testing had a 6300U in it. You can get all the way up to like an i7. It is active cooling. It's not silent, right? It does have a fan, although the fan most of the time isn't really running unless you're kind of, you know, really pushing it. But man, the amazing thing on this, and just the thing that sells it, is the screen. Now realize this laptop has like four different SKUs to it, and mm-hmm. the OLED is only one of those four, and you end up paying like another $100 or $200 price premium in order to get that. But it is just worth every penny, really. I mean, you're getting an amazing display. It's the thing, it's probably the thing you're using the most on your laptop, right? When you're using it, you're looking at the screen, you know, and it's something that's a small device and you kind of care about the screen quality even more than, you know, any other kind of form factor of a thing. But man, just using, you know, I had looked at OLED displays, like as far as television sets, you know, in the past, but something about it being on, you know, and I've even seen it on phone screens, but something about when it's on a laptop size screen, like a 14-inch screen, and they go a little bit higher on the resolution than your kind of standard resolution. So it's I think it's a 25 by 16 or 14, you know, display. But something about that in combination with OLED just makes it look sharper than that same screen and an LCD at that same resolution. And it's it mostly boils down to just the way that the lighting kind of pipes through from OLED, right? So if you actually, if you click on that image, it should blow it up even more a little bit. If you just look, usually if you look really close at any LCD screen with the magnifying glass or whatnot, you'll see actual, you know, red, green, blue kind of bands on the edges on either side of the text. And it even got to the point where Microsoft kind of made like this, you know, the clear type thing, which kind of like makes your resolution appear a little bit, you know, higher kind of artificially, because it's using the fact that those pixels are side by side like that, the subpixels, kind of uses that to its advantage. If you look at the text here, it's basically going from white to black with a very little bit of a color, anything around the edges. And that's that picture right there is probably the best way that I could try to demonstrate it. It's really one of those things where you just have to be like sitting in front of it and just look at the screen to just really get a true understanding of just how much sharper that makes the text look. And you combine that with the fact that it is OLED. So when there is black text, it's literally like a black hole. Like there's just there's zero light coming through there. There's no backlight sleeve.
That is the glory of the OLED.
Yeah, exactly. And so it just makes the overall experience just much, much nicer. Even to the point where in some cases the contrast is actually too much. Like if you're running with a black background and you don't think about it and you just like turn up the brightness on the screen, because there is still a brightness adjustment, you know, there's still hotkeys on the Lenovo, just like on any other laptop. If you turn it up and you were looking at, you know, mostly black content on the screen, and then you did something like open up a Windows Explorer window, which is white, like it's like the sun just rose in your face. Like, you know, if you had the brightness too high. So you actually have to, you know, be mindful that the contrast, the incredible contrast of the screen can actually fool you and throw you off. And Lenovo even added some other options within their software that you know, they're kind of like in the box software that comes with it, so that you can do things like dim the taskbar by 50%, just like all the time. Because if you're one of those people that has the taskbar up all the time, you would, first of all, if you had like a very bright colored taskbar, that would just be like annoyingly like blinding to you. But then also, you have to remember it is OLED. So if you spend the entire life of this product showing the same thing on a screen, like you could potentially still get some kind of a burn-in effect on OLED. It's not so much burn-in as it is, you know, over time, over a long time now. It used to be really a significant issue, but if you, you know, use this thing for several years or something and just had it like up 24/7 and you were showing the same thing on the screen, those particular pixels would go a little bit dimmer than the rest of them. And then that would look like a burn-in to you. Although technically it's kind of like burnout, really, if you think about it.
It's a thin line.
But yeah. But yeah, just an amazing screen on that thing. I hope, you know, aside from this product being pretty cool and you know, it is a little bit spendy. I think this model I tested runs at around like $1,500. But you know, good durability, like, you know, all that stuff is there. It's you know, it's the Lenovo product. It's a ThinkPad line. So you're getting all those kind of business level things. I just want to see these displays in everything now. Like,
yeah,
they just need to be in everything. It's as simple as that. You know, like, especially, I couldn't even imagine like a nice desktop display with OLED in it. That would just be phenomenal. Yeah, that's about all I can say about that. Oh yeah, and I know your Dell system you were talking about. Like, you could purchase the pen for it, right? Mm-hmm. This one, it's built in and it's super cap and it charges in like 10 seconds or something, and you can use it for like an hour. So pretty cool there. And it's like, you don't have to worry about like, oh, where do I put the pen? Like, where's the pen holder? It's like part of the body. There's actually a, you know, a slot for it. It just slides in. So pretty cool there. They're actually between models right now. So if you wanted to pick one of these up right this second, you actually can't. Cause they're switching from Skylake to Cabby Lake. And so they kind of like paused their shipment of these things, but Cabby Lake one should be, you know, just as cool. We saw it at CES. They made some, you know, slight changes to the body and how the keys retract mm-hmm. when you flip it around the other way and stuff like that. But the screen is still the same. So,
well, the big attraction with Cabby Lake is the reduced power consumption.
Yeah.
At least that we've seen in some of the other models.
Yep. And I think they're keeping the battery the same capacity in, you know, in the newer model. So for probably the first time in a long time, you'll see, you know, one generation to the next where they didn't actually like start skimping on the battery to like, just make the battery life equal. You would actually get more battery life out of it.
This episode is brought to you by Blue Apron. Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone while supporting a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs. Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with fresh, high-quality ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals for less than $10 a person. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card, pre-portioned ingredients, and can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. How convenient is that? Blue Apron sets the highest quality standards for their community of over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the United States. Seafood is sourced sustainably under standards developed in partnership with the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch. Beef, chicken, and pork from responsibly raised animals. Produce is sourced from farms that practice regenerative farming. And because Blue Apron ships the exact amount of each ingredient required for a recipe, they are reducing food waste. How cool is that? The freshness guarantee promises that every ingredient in your delivery arrives ready to cook or they'll make it right. Blue Apron delivers to 99% of the continental U.S. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want them. Customize your recipes every week based on your dietary preferences, and you get to choose from a variety of new recipes each week or let Blue Apron's culinary team surprise you. Recipes are not repeated within a year, so you'll never get bored. Roasted pork with apple, walnut, and farro salad. Crispy barramundi with quinoa and roasted carrot salad. Udon noodle soup with miso and soft-boiled eggs. It's wide and varied and delicious, people. Check out this week's menu and get three meals free with your first purchase with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/twitch. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. Don't wait. Go to blueapron.com/twitch. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. And a great way to learn how to cook, too. They got everything you need in the box to your house. It couldn't be simpler.
I thought this was really interesting. Jeremy wrote this up. 50 gigabytes of high-resolution fallout. Finally, a use for that 8 gigabytes of VRAM. And he's referring to a hard OCP write-up. And Jeremy writes, for those who want the answer immediately, the largest amount of VRAM hard OCP saw utilized was a hair over 5 gigabytes, in most cases more than double the usage than the default textures use. So this certainly suggests that those with 4 gigabyte cards should reconsider installing the texture pack and that a 6 gigabyte card shouldn't see performance impacts. As for the performance deltas, well, we can't provide spoilers for their entire review, which I completely agree with. You know, but if you're kind of curious whether you really need an 8 gigabyte card, this latest write-up from Hard OCP will probably give you a good idea of what's going on, at least in terms of Fallout 4. How many gigabytes are you running on your GPU at this point, Alan?
What have I gotten here? I've just got like a 960.
Right.
Which is now I'm. Now I'm drawing a blank. What would be on a 960? Like, I'm forgetting what the increment is. Is it like,
right?
Is it like 6 gigs?
2, 4, 8, 6.
Oh wait, no, it's a 9. It's a 980. Sorry.
Okay.
It's like a, you know, one of the older, like a PNY 980.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm actually not sure how much VRAM is on there, but again, I mean, I'm not gaming left and right on this machine anyway, so.
Right.
I'm definitely not playing games with 50 gig worth of textures.
It was interesting because
they looked at a GTX 1060 with 6 gigabytes of RAM, an 8 gigabyte RX 480, an 8 gigabyte GTX 1080, and a R9 Fury 10 or R9 Fury X, which only had 4 gigabytes of dedicated VRAM on board. If you're curious whether or not you can handle the high resolution texture packs, head over to hardocp.com and take a look at that review. It is interesting and surprising that given how massive, you know, the high resolution texture pack is for you know, for Fallout, how modest, or I guess you could also think that it's kind of crazy when you think of, you know, a year or two ago, the idea of using all 4 gigabytes of memory on your card, much less 5 gigabytes, would sound kind of crazy. But 6 gigabytes is kind of looking like a sweet spot right now.
Yeah, yeah. So my 980 has 4. That was the...
Yeah.
I had to go back and look.
Did Ryan used to talk
all
about...
the stuff. All the stuff Sorry. Now is like 6 gigs, so I was just like, you know, almost wanted to mistakenly assume that mine was also 6. Anyway.
So many 6 gigabyte cards out there.
Yep, yep.
I kid.
speaking of 6 gigabyte cards. Oh wait.
Go for it, man.
Actually, no, that is a 6 gigabyte card. The is that what you want to talk about next? The ICX?
Absolutely.
So I was kind of skulking around while Ryan was testing this last week. Pretty cool. You're basically taking a 1080. Like a typical EVGA, you know, GTX 1080 FTW card. And EVGA had some issues recently where I think they forgot to put a thermal pad on one of the voltage regulator modules and, you know, it started to try to cook something, or it was something to do with, I forget which exact part it was. But they, in addition to correcting that issue, they kind of took a round turn on just like a mentality shift on how you regulate the temperature of the things on your GPU. So typically what you'll see is there will just be a GPU temperature, like temperature of the actual chip that's doing all of the number crunching. And the temperature of that will be the thing that feeds back into how quickly the fans run or what kind of fan profile you run or whatnot. Well, EVGA decided to try to make a different version of that. And they said, well, what if we took the cooler and we kind of split it into two sections. So you had like a left section that was the section like with its heat pipes and its fan that was cooling the GPU itself. But hey, the VRMs and the other parts actually make a decent amount of heat too. And though the heat they're making is not necessarily, it's not necessarily proportional or directly proportional to how much heat the GPU is kicking out. Right.
Right.
You know, VRMs can actually make a decent amount of heat even when they're not providing that much power, right? Because it's the switching that's the inefficient thing. So they kind of segmented it off and they said, okay, the left half is doing the GPU. The right half is looking at other temperature sensors that are kind of on the PCB or close to where the voltage regulator circuitry is. And that kind of feeds into what it controls the speed of the right side fan. So you could potentially have the GPU running totally idle where normally no fans would be running your GPU, but you might actually have the right side fan running at a very low speed because the voltage regulator modules would have actually started running pretty hot, even in an idle condition, right? Right. You know, they run pretty hot, not because they're drawing so much power, but because they're drawing a decent amount of power compared to there being no cooling. You know, in a completely idle thing, right?
Right.
You know, the things will eventually start to cook, right? So it's pretty cool in implementation. They actually put like 3 different LEDs along the top edge of the board, and the LEDs light up different colors based on what the temperature ranges are of the GPU or the voltage regulator modules, or I think third is the memory. You know, so they're able to, you can get some visual feedback from this card, which right. is now called the FTW2 card, as opposed to just the FTW. If for people that purchased the FTW version of this card, and they kind of feel a little bit slighted maybe, and they're like, oh, but I want this better one now that it's out, and I don't want to have to buy a brand new card. EVGA has a kind of an exchange program. You have to pay $100. But you get a new FTW2 card. You turn in your previous version, and then the reason that's $100 is, you know, you're getting better hardware with all the temperature monitoring and all the other stuff, but you're also, you know, EVGA has to sell your old card in like a remanufactured status. So, mm-hmm. you know, they're kind of, you know, you're scratching each other's back as far as who's eating cost on what, right? as far as the potential customer right now that's toggling between the FTW and the FTW2, which just launched, it is a $30 price difference. So it's already like a $650 card. $30 might not really be a deal breaker for someone that just wants a little bit more temperature monitoring capability. You know, they added extra features like GUI to the EVGA software that lets you, you know, control which fans are doing what based on temperatures of what. It's actually pretty cool looking, you know, additions that they did there. So, you know, interesting idea. I haven't heard of an awful lot of people complaining that like their GPU failed early just because their VRMs were running hotter. Right. You know, I mean, it does make a difference, but the difference is in like decades or something out as far as like how long these parts are going to take to fail most likely. So that's not really a huge reason to justify doing it. The other issue is Ryan didn't see any better performance out of FTW2.
Right.
You might potentially be able to squeeze some more performance if maybe those voltage regulators were running a little bit less stable at the higher temperature. Like, it could be a thing, but we didn't see it, right? So it's the kind of a thing where if you do get any kind of a gain out of this at all, performance-wise, it's going to be pretty small. In the end, it really just boils down to, you know, cool extra feature, more feedback on what temperatures are doing. Maybe extreme overclocking liquid nitrogen folks, or this would probably be the thing that they just get because it just comes with more temperature monitoring on it. You know, maybe they might need that or want that, right? You know, but, you know, still cool additions nonetheless. With something like this, I would imagine eventually you just kind of shift to the point where just this is just the standard thing, like probably the next generation NVIDIA chip to come out. You know, would probably just have this extra temperature monitoring capability kind of built into the whole thing. And, you know, you don't have to worry about EVGA kind of tacking it on after the fact.
We wait with bated breath. And,
yep,
bigger performance deltas.
Yep. And cooler temperatures.
Oh, my goodness. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by BarkBox. BarkBox delivers 4 to 6 natural treats and fun toys for your dog curated around a surprise theme each and every month. BarkBox paw picks the best all-natural treats and innovative toys to match your dog's unique needs, including allergies and heavy chewer preferences. All edibles are made in the USA or Canada, and 100% of their products are tested on animals, their own. They know how much you love your pet. They know you want to keep your pet safe. And they're doing their best over at BarkBox. It's a great way to find a variety of treats and toys from local and small businesses that you might not otherwise be able to find. BarkBox also makes their own paw ducks through their Bark & Co. brand. They've shipped over 16 million toys and treats so far. Getting started is so easy. Choose your dog size, small and cute up to 20 pounds, just right 20 to 50 pounds, or big and bold, that's 50 plus pounds. Choose a plan. 1, 6, or 12-month plans are available. And get your BarkBox. BarkBoxes are shipped on the 15th of each month. So cool. BarkBox is going to keep your dog engaged, interested, and happy. If your dog doesn't like something in the BarkBox, BarkBox will send you something else for free. Scout's honor. When your dog falls in love with something from the box, you can easily find it again on BarkShop.com or the BarkBox app. You can cancel anytime. Shipping is free in the continental U.S. Bring some joy into your dog's life. You know your puppers has earned it. Give your dog the joy of a million belly scratches. Get 1 month free and free shipping with your 6 or 12 month subscription by visiting getbarkbox.com/twit. That's getbarkbox.com/twit. We want to thank BarkBox for their support. So many dog toys, so hard to find. Trust BarkBox, people. Oh, my goodness. It's always nice to find something new for the puppy. Although my puppy's 14, but she still acts like a puppy.
Mm-hmm.
Huawei Mate 9 review, Leica and Bifrost. This is a pretty big phone announcement at CES, the Huawei Mate 9. Sebastian's got a write-up on it up on PCPer.com. I had my grubby little paws on this 6-inch smartphone at CES. It feels fantastic. Kirin 960 system on a chip. That's the Bifrost GPU architecture inside of there. They've got a Leica branded dual camera system inside of it. You know, this was kind of impressive.
The camera specifically. Yeah. I find the camera very, very impressive for a phone.
Yeah,
especially.
It was funny. The photos seemed a little, I want to say they were a little fuzzy at CES, but I think it was completely a firmware issue because I've seen the pictures. If you go to PC Perspective, PCPro.com, and look at the Huawei Mate 9 review, there's a bunch of sample images in there, a ton of sample images in there, and comparisons to other phone cameras. But this is, you know, when you're looking at like a $600 phone, the specs are fantastic. You know, the octa-core system on a chip that's, 4x2.4 gigahertz Cortex A73 cores plus 4 1.8 gigahertz Cortex A53 plus the i6 coprocessor, the Mali G71 MP8 graphics, 4 gigabytes of memory, a 5.9-inch 1080p display. And before you're like, Quad HD, I mean, Quad HD is mostly about sucking down battery life without giving you any real serious visible improvement. Feel free to flame me on that one. 64 gigabytes of storage. The Leica dual camera, 12 megapixel RGB plus 20 MP, front camera's an 8 megapixel sensor, f1.9, the 26 millimeter lens, 1080p 30 frame per second video on that one, 1080p 60 frames per second on the primary camera, and also a 2160p by 30 frames per second mode. Metric ton of networking options, 802.11 AC Wi-Fi, plus Bluetooth 4.2. There's a fingerprint sensor, the G sensor, gyroscope, compass, ambient light sensor, proximity sensor, hall sensor, barometer, IR. I want an app to access the barometer. USB Type-C, 4,000 milliamp hour battery. And it's selling for $600 on Amazon.com.
Yeah.
And I feel comfortable in saying that Sebastian loved this phone.
Yeah, just to focus on that camera stuff a little more, there's some trickery going on there that's actually pretty cool. So you have 20 megapixel monochrome sensor combined with 12 megapixel RGB, right?
Yeah.
You can do, like, if you have to think about it for a second. Like, as far as detail goes, out of your typical digital camera that takes color pictures, it actually has to do a bunch of tricks to try to get detail out of, you know, a third of the number of pixels that it actually has, right? Or some ratio close to that. You know, it has to have, because it has to be able to determine color of those places along with the detail, right? But if you take two separate cameras, it's probably the same actual sensor. It just doesn't have an RGB mask in it, right? It's not dividing the colors up. It's just treating everything as just monochrome image. And by doing that, you can get, you know, way more detail out of your shots. And then you can kind of like do some kind of tricks there, you know, with all of the CPU processing power that this thing has. Right after you take the shot, it can kind of mesh both of those things together and come up with a really great shot, right? You know, potentially. Like, you know, good color reproduction, but at the same time, like the detail would be sharper than any, you know, any regular just 12 megapixel, you know, phone camera sensor could provide, because it has that extra sensor. Getting that more detail out of the shot. Pretty cool stuff.
Mm-hmm. It is pretty impressive. iPhone 8 rumors started to ramp up. I feel like we touched on them last week, but they are picking up speed along with the announcements of Macworld moving to San Jose this summer. But Apple Insider's got a nice article by Mikey Campbell. Apple's iPhone 8 to replace Touch ID home button with function area start at $1,000. That's according to KGI analyst Ming Chi Kwa, or Cao. I apologize if I'm saying that incorrectly. But it's interesting. If you look at that graph there, there's a gray block on the right side, and that's there's a little rectangle at the bottom of that they're calling the function area, which is the portion of the extra screen real estate that will behave as if there are virtual buttons there. But the big thing, it's a big 5.8-inch physical OLED screen. What else is going to be going on there is, you know, vague, of course, because it's so early. But Qua believes that iPhone 8 will incorporate new biorecognition assets to take over device security and Apple Pay authentication duties. So we'll see. We'll see about that. Not too specific on the ideas on that in the article. Up on Apple Insider.
There have been patents floating around where, like, they have a patent for Touch ID through a display,
right?
So that's already there. You know, I would imagine that's probably going to be part of that. You're able to. They would be able to extend the OLED display all the way down into that function area.
Yes,
because OLED is super, super thin. So the reason the displays end at where they do now on iPhones is you have things like the speakers and the other stuff near the bottom edge there that, you know, you couldn't even make the display kind of butt into that if you wanted to. Mm-hmm. With OLED, like, that's, you know, you're taking millimeters off of the thickness of the display itself, which, you know, if you've ever opened up even a recent iPhone, the display is still a reasonably thick thing. Mm-hmm. You know, if you could take that down to like a millimeter or two compared to, like, you know, more than that, what it is now, that's going to make a big difference. So, interesting stuff. I'm interested to see what this thing looks like when it finally comes out.
I am too. Talking about OLEDs, Korea Herald basically confirming, claiming that Samsung Display has received a display panel order from Apple for an additional 5 trillion won. That's $4.35 billion U.S. in organic light-emitting diodes. Totaling 13 trillion won so far, Samsung Display has proved a major supplier for Apple's upcoming iPhone models, sources said Monday. Basically, we're talking about 60 million OLED panels, and it looks like Samsung is the biggest supplier of Apple's next smartphone. At least that's what the Korea Herald believes. So, and then there's a beautiful picture of a flexible display screen. And apparently 100 million flexible OLED panels are being sold to Apple. I'm kind of curious about that one, to say the very least.
You know, I mean, there's the flash that's in iPhones is already like majority of what the memory being used is from Samsung in the first place. So it's not like this is the first part that, you know, Apple kind of relies on, you know, heavily from Samsung for. So
I just want to see flexible, displays that don't break easily, especially given that they're OLED. And one last thought on iPhone rumors before we go. Apple's joined the Wireless Power Consortium /Key, lending weight to rumor of wireless charging for iPhone 8, writes 9to5Mac. So, you know, and above and beyond that, I'm not going to get into the rumors of whether or not Apple will actually include a charger in the box or charge you extra. Hint, my money is on that they're going to charge you extra. and Apple provided, Apple provided this quote, Business Insider, quote, Apple is an active member of many standards development organizations, is both a leader and contributor. Apple is joining the Wireless Power Consortium to be able to participate and contribute ideas to the open, collaborative development of future wireless charging standards. We look forward to working together with the WPC and its members.
So, sounds surprisingly open for Apple.
It's a statement, dude.
Yeah, I know.
Just wait till they release a proprietary wireless charging standard. That'd be perfect.
They just want to go wireless charging so they can get rid of the Lightning connector too. So now you just have nothing on your phone.
Don't no connectors. Get me started. You know, connectors are overrated. Everybody just needs to spend a little bit more money and do it the way Apple does it, and we'll all be happier.
They just want to make phones like, you know, you build the chip in a bottle. They just want the whole phone like glass all the way around. One piece of glass. And they'll somehow just, like, you know, they'll stick the OLED screen in there rolled up, and then they'll just kind of like unroll it into the across the thing and just be like, another plug the little hole, and that'll be it. Ship in a bottle iPhone.
Basically, you're saying if it's impossible to repair, impossible to fix.
Yeah, the iFixit grade will be like -10.
For the first time, we've gone into negative and imaginary numbers to describe the repairability of a phone. I don't know. I would like to see, you know, an iPhone, you know, screen that goes all the way out to the edges, a bezel-less iPhone. It's interesting, right? You know,
yeah.
9to5Mac has a whole rumors page, 9to5Mac.com/guide/iPhone-8. Concept images, imagine rumored stainless steel sides with curved glass edges, 3D touch pressure sensitive sensor to work with flexible OLED display. We talked about that last week. Will it, you know, introduce facial recognition features? Better waterproofing than iPhone 7, like IP68
ratings. Actually, That makes a lot of sense as to why they would want, why they would specifically be looking for like flexible OLED. In other words, OLED that's rated to flex slightly, right? Because that'll let them have that, the OLED layer even closer to the surface,
right?
And still, you know, still be able to use, you know, their touch based, kind of like their pressure sensitivity based technology in there too. Because they kind of have to keep that around now that they've already introduced that in the 6, right? Or in the 6S. So,
yeah,
you know, they can't, like, you know, remove that feature because there's already an ecosystem around, like, you know, it might not be everywhere and in everything on iPhones yet, but, you know, it is at use and they couldn't really just, like, get rid of it.
We'll see.
Yeah.
Why be common when you can be proprietary?
Sure.
I don't know. I don't know where I'm going with that. But with that, ladies and gentlemen, PCPro.com is a place to find Alan Malventano. And of course, the man himself, Mr. Ryan Shrout. You can find me at techthing.com or avxl.com. You can find more of this hardware podcast at twit.tv/TWICH, including all the RSS links to download it and all of our older episodes. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Alan Malventano.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.